Leave me, Scott. She doesn't need a mother like me.
I don't agree, but it's your choice, Scott said. I'll send him in.
Lexi sat up straighter, and then he was there, in the doorway. It hurt more than she'd expected, more than the labor she'd just suffered through. He stood tall, bigger than she remembered, his shoulders broader. Wheat blonde hair fell across his eyes, and she remembered how much he used to hate that, how she'd laugh when she pushed it aside to see his eyes as he leaned down to kiss her. She loved him so much. It wasn't only in her blood, the way she loved him. It was her blood. She didn't know if everyone else was right, and her love for him would someday begin to fade like an old photograph. How could she know that? She only knew that her love for him was the very best of her, and without it, her heart would be empty. He moved closer, looking uncertain. She was glad her daughter was in her arms, because she would have touched him. She wouldn't have been able to stop herself. Up close, she saw the scar along his jawline. The wrinkled skin was the same pink as their baby's face. Soon, maybe, it would be gone altogether, or become too fine to see. But it was there now, a visible reminder of her crime.
"Hi, Zach," she said, hearing the tremble in her voice.
He drew in a breath, saying her name quietly. And there, finally, was the heartache. His voice reminded her of nights on the beach, of kisses that went on all night, of dreams and futures.
"She looks just like Mia," he said.
And with that, the past was here with them again, standing alongside this bundled-up bit of the future. Lexi wanted to apologize again, but she held back. There was no point anymore. Those days were over. This was about something else. Someone else.
"I would name her Grace," Lexi said, wiping her eyes, "if it was up to me."
"You're her mother," Zach said.
Her mother.
"I thought you wanted to name. I thought you liked Katya."
She drew in a breath at that. So he remembered. It felt like a lifetime ago, that conversation of hope between two kids who thought that love was easy. They'd been on their beach, spinning diaphanous dreams of the future. "My friend, Tamika, is a Catholic. She says when God forgives you, he grants you grace." She looked down at her daughter.
"Gracie, is that you?"
The baby made a mewling sound and Lexi started to cry.
"Don't cry, baby," she said, kissing the tiny pink lips.
Then she looked up at Zach.
"Tell her I loved her enough to do what was best for her."
"I'll bring her to visit."
"No."
She kissed her daughter one last time, and then slowly, slowly, handed her to Zach.
I don't want her to grow up like I did. Keep her away from me."
He took the small bundle in his arms.
"Grace," he said. "Grace Mia Faraday."
Lexi felt the pain of that.
"I love you, Gracie," she whispered,
wishing she'd kissed her daughter one more time before she handed her over.
"And Zach, I..."
There was a knock at the door. It was so loud it startled her.
"That will be my mom," Zach said. "What were you going to say?"
Lexi shook her head.
"It doesn't matter."
He paused, moved his gaze from the baby to Lexi.
"I ruined everything," he said softly.
She couldn't find her voice, not even to say goodbye to her daughter, or the boy she loved. Jude had tried to prepare for this day. She told herself this would be it, the start of a new Jude.
And so when Zack came out of Lexi's hospital room, holding a pink-wrapped newborn, his eyes glazed with emotion, Jude felt hope rising within her, standing tall.
"Grace Mia Faraday," Zack said. "She's gorgeous," Miles said, coming up beside his son, cupping the baby's small head in his long surgeon's hand.
Jude looked down into her granddaughter's small face, and time seemed to fall away. For a second, she was a young mother herself, with a baby in each arm and Miles beside her. Grace looked exactly like Mia, the same bow-shaped lips and muddy blue eyes that would turn green, the same pointed chin and white blonde eyelashes. Jude drew back instinctively.
"Mom," Zack said, looking up at her, "do you want to hold her?"
Jude started to shake. The cold in her heart radiated out to her fingers, and she wished she'd brought a coat. "Of course." She made herself smile and reach out, taking Mia, no, Grace, in her arms, holding her close. "Love her," she thought desperately, beginning to panic. "Feel something." But there was nothing. She stared down at her own granddaughter, this baby who looked enough like Mia to fool anyone. And Jude felt nothing at all. Physically, Lexi healed quickly. Her boobs shrank back to their normal size and her milk dried up. Within a month, a few pale silvery lines on her lower belly were the only evidence that she'd ever had a child. She felt as faded as those marks. Pregnancy had changed her. A girl named Alexa Bale had gone into that hospital, chained to a bed, and given birth to the most beautiful baby in the world. She'd seen the boy she loved one last time. And then, it was all gone, and an older, wiser Lexi had come back to Purdy. Before, she'd been fragile, even hopeful. She saw that now, the way you saw a missing fence post. The lack stood out. She'd been damaged, broken by the terrible thing she'd done, but she'd believed in redemption, in the power of justice. She'd thought that going to prison would be an atonement, and that with atonement, she could be forgiven. What a crock. Her lawyer had been right. She should have fought the charges, said she was sorry and young and stupid. Instead, she'd done the right thing and been crushed. She'd lost everything that mattered to her. But nothing hurt more than the loss of her child. In the past few months, she tried to hold on to who she was, but the best parts of her were draining away. Day after day, she attempted to write letters to Grace, and each new failure stripped away a piece of her. Until now, there was so little left, she felt transparent. She was in the yard, sitting on a bench beneath a pale denim sky. Over to her left, some khaki-clad women were playing basketball. The trees outside the prison were in full, vibrant bloom. Every now and then, a pink blossom floated over the skeletal mountain of razor wire and landed on the ground like an impossibly kept promise.
"You look like someone who could use a boost."
Lexi looked up. The woman standing there had a carrot-colored crew cut and a blue kerchief tied around her shorn head. A snake tattoo peeked out from her collar. She was a stocky woman with powerful hands and skin that looked like someone had scrubbed at her cheeks with steel wool. Lexi knew who this woman was. Everyone did. Her nickname, Smack, said it all. Lexi got slowly to her feet. In the 11 months she'd been here, she'd never spoken to Smack. There was only one reason women befriended Smack, and once you started talking to her, you never stopped.
"I can make your pain go away," Smack said.
Lexi knew it was wrong, dangerous to listen to that promise, but she couldn't help herself. This pain of hers was unbearable, especially today. "How much?" Smack smiled slowly,
revealing black, ugly teeth. Meth. Mouths like that were a dime a dozen in here. For the first time, a sweet thing like you, I think...
You get the hell away from her, Smack!
Lexi saw Tamika barreling this way like a mama grizzly bear. She put a paw-sized hand on Lexi's chest and pushed her aside hard. Lexi stumbled, almost fell. She regained her balance quickly and surged forward.
This is my business, Tamika. You can't tell me what to do.
Tamika went toe-to-toe with Smack.
Back off, or I'll take you apart like cheap-ass furniture.
Lexi pushed in between the women.
I need it, she said to Tamika, almost pleading. I can't stand it anymore. I don't want to feel anything.
Hold out your hand, Smack whispered.
No,
Tamika said. I won't let you do this, Hermana.
Lexi made a roaring, wailing sound of pure, unadulterated pain and punched Tamika in the nose. A whistle blew. Smack slipped two pills into Lexi's hand and then ran so fast it was as if she'd never been there.
You crazy?
Tamika said, stumbling back.
I don't know why I care about you.
I don't either. I never asked you to.
Hermana,
Tamika said, sighing. I know how much it hurts.
Do you? A year ago today, I killed my best friend.
Two guards stepped in between them, pushed Lexi away from Tamika.
Back up, Bale.
I fell,
Tamika said.
Nice try, Hernandez,
one of the guards said.
I saw the whole thing. Come on, Bale.
Lexi knew where they were taking her. Knew, and didn't care. Yesterday, she would have said that nothing scared her more than going to the hole. But now, on the anniversary of Mia's death, in a world where Lexi had had a child and lost her, it barely warranted a sigh. They led her down one hallway after another, finally coming to a small, windowless room. When the door opened, Lexi got a whiff of urine and filth, and she started to panic, to turn away.
Too late,
the guard nearest her said, giving her a shove inside. There was a rough steel-gray blanket on a metal bed. The mattress and pillow were made of old, misshapen rubber. The only opening in the door, the size of a TV remote. Food probably came through that slot 3 times a day. Lexi stood in the darkness, shivering suddenly, although it wasn't cold. The stench of the cell was making her eyes water.
You're here, one of the guards said. Learn something.
The door clanged shut, and she was in the dark. Lexi stood there, freezing already. She opened her palm. It was too dark to see the pills, but she felt them. She put them in her mouth and swallowed them without water. It took a while for them to take effect, but finally, a calm settled over her. She closed her eyes and forgot all about Mia's off-key singing and Zack's whispered words of love and Grace's mewling baby sounds. She sat on the cell's rubber mattress staring at nothing, thinking nothing, just passing through time that felt interminable. Part 2. Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. William Wordsworth. Ode. Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood. Chapter 18. 2010. From a distance, the Faraday family appeared to have healed. Miles, the renowned surgeon, was back to doing what he did best, and if he spent too many hours in the OR, it seemed right that he should save as many lives as he could. Zack had surprised everyone who knew him by blistering through both junior college and the University of Washington. He'd graduated in 3 years and started medical school a year early. Now he was in his second year and his grades were stellar. He had moved into a rental house not far away, and he did two things in his life, school and fatherhood. There was no time for anything else, and he seemed not to care. Islanders spoke of him often, saying how tragedy had shaped him and how well he'd risen to the challenge of fatherhood. And then, there was Jude. For years, she had tried to reclaim the woman she'd been before her daughter's death. She'd done what was asked of her, what was expected. She'd gone to support groups and therapists. She'd taken Xanax and Zoloft and Prozac at various times. She'd slept too much and then too little. She'd lost too much weight. Mostly, she'd learned that some pain simply could neither be cured, nor ignored, nor healed. Time hadn't healed her wounds. What a crock of shit that little cliché was. The kind of thing lucky people said to those who were less fortunate. Those same lucky people thought that talking about grief helped, and they thought nothing of telling you to try to get on with your life. Finally, she stopped expecting to feel better, and that was when she found a way to live. She couldn't control her grief or her life or much of anything, really. That was what she knew now. But she could control her emotions. Now she was careful, deliberate, brittle. That most of all. She was like an antique porcelain vase that had been broken and painstakingly repaired. Every scar was visible up close, and only the gentlest touch could be used in handling the piece. But from a distance, from across the room, in the right light, it looked whole. She followed a rigid routine. She'd learned that a schedule could save her. A to-do list could be the framework for a life. Wake up, shower, make coffee, pay bills, go to the grocery store, the post office, the dry cleaners, put gas in the car. This was how she moved through life. She cut and styled her hair, even though she didn't care how she looked. She wore makeup. She dressed carefully. Otherwise, people would frown at her and say, "How are you, really?" Better to look healthy and keep moving. On most days, that worked for her. She woke up and made it through the interminable daylight hours. On weekdays, she fed her granddaughter breakfast and drove her to kindergarten. A few hours later, she picked Grace up from the elementary school and dropped her off at the afternoon daycare program that allowed Zach to spend his days in medical school. She'd learned that if she focused on the minutiae of life, she could keep her grief at bay. Most days, anyway. Today, though, no amount of pretending could protect her. Today was the 8th of June. Tomorrow was the 6th anniversary of Mia's death. Jude stood in her designer kitchen, staring at the 8-burner stove. Sunlight slanted through the window, made the tiny bronze flecks in the granite countertop sparkle. Miles came up beside her and kissed her cheek.
"Zach and Grace will be here in an hour."
She nodded. It occurred to her a moment too late that she could have turned into his arms and kissed him back, but as with so many things, her timing was off. She watched him move away from her, saw the distance between them expanding. It was a skill she'd acquired. She actually saw empty space now. She knew he was disappointed in her, in their marriage, just as she knew that he still loved her. At least, he wanted to. And for Miles, desire and reality were the same thing, because he made it so. Now, almost 6 years later, he still believed in them. He woke every day and thought, today. Today would be the day she'd remember how to love him again. She went to the fridge for the ground beef and pork, and set about the comforting task of making meatballs. The next hour passed in dicing vegetables, making meatballs, frying them up. By the time her sauce was made, the whole house smelled of red wine-based tomato sauce
and savory, thyme-rich meatballs. A humid sweetness hung in the air as water boiled on the stove. She turned the sauce down to simmer and made the salad. She was just closing the refrigerator door when she heard a car drive up. She tucked the hair behind her ear, feeling the coarse new strands of gray that threaded through the blonde, tactile reminders of her loss. As she neared the living room, Miles saw her coming and met her halfway, putting an arm around her waist. Grace walked into the sunlit entry. In her butterfly print capri pants and smocked pink blouse, with her corn silk blonde hair fighting its way out of a lopsided ponytail, she looked like a little wood sprite. It wasn't until you studied her small, heart-shaped face with its pointed chin and sharp nose that you saw that there was nothing truly elfin about the serious child in front of you. Like the rest of them, she rarely smiled and laughed quietly, covering her mouth with her hand as if the sound were unpleasant. Miles released his hold on Jude and went to his granddaughter, scooping her up in his arms and twirling her around.
"And how is my little poppet today?"
Jude flinched at the endearment. She'd tried to stop her husband from using it, but he said he couldn't do it, that he looked at Grace and saw Mia, and the nickname slipped out. Jude saw Mia in Grace, too. That was the problem. Every time Jude looked at this child, the wound reopened.
"I'm good, Papa," she said. "I found an arrowhead on the beach at recess."
"No, you didn't," Zack said, kicking the door shut behind him.
"I could have," Grace said.
"But you didn't. Jacob Moore found it, and you punched him in the nose when he wouldn't give it to you."
"Jacob Moore?" Miles said, peering down at his granddaughter through the rimless glasses he now wore.
"Isn't he the kid who looks like Bigfoot?"
Grace giggled and covered her mouth, nodding.
"He's 7, she whispered solemnly. "And in kindergarten."
"Don't encourage her, Dad,"
Zack said, tossing his keys on the table by the door.
"She's already looking at cage fighting as her only career option."
He hung up his backpack, pausing for a second at the green sweater still hanging in place on the coat rack. His long fingers brushed the fabric. They all did that, touched the sweater like a talisman every time they came into the house. Then he turned away and headed toward the great room. Jude was so removed from her own life that she saw her son from a distance even when he was right in front of her. His blonde hair had grown out again. It was too long, messy, and unkempt. His jawline was stubbly. His beard grew in some places and not others because of the burn. His shirt was on inside out and probably had been all day. And when he took off his sneakers, his socks didn't match. Worse than all of that was the exhaustion in his eyes. No doubt he'd spent last night studying and still gotten up bright and early to make Grace breakfast. One day, he was just going to drop where he stood.
"You want a beer?"
Miles said to his son as he leaned down to kiss Grace's pink cheek.
"I'm not allowed to drink beer," she said brightly.
"Very funny, young lady. I was asking your daddy."
"Sure,"
Zack said. Jude grabbed 2 beers from the fridge and poured herself a white wine. Then she followed her men out to the patio. She sat down in the lounge chair by the barbecue. Miles was to her left, and Zack sat at the outdoor table, slumped in an armchair, with his stockinged feet planted up on the table. Grace walked past them and sat alone at the edge of the grass, where she started to talk to her own wrist.
"She's still got her invisible friend, I see,"
Miles said.
"Ordinary kids have invisible friends," Zack said. "Grace has an invisible alien friend who is a princess trapped in a jar on her planet, and that's the least of our problems."
He took a sip of beer and set the bottle aside.
"Her teacher says she has trouble making friends.
She lies about everything, and she's started asking about her mother. She wants to know why she doesn't live with us and where she is.
Jude straightened in her chair.
She needs us more, Miles said. Maybe I should quit med school for a while, Zack said,
and it was obvious from his voice and his body language that he'd been considering this for a while.
Third year is supposed to be wicked hard, and honestly, I'm jammed as it is. Every second of my life, I'm either studying or rushing to be with Grace. When I'm with her, I'm so tired, I'm useless.
You know what she said to me last night?
Daddy, I can take care of myself if you're too tired to make dinner.
He ran a hand through his hair.
She's 5 and a half, for God's sake, and she's worried about me.
And you're 24, Miles said. You're doing a hell of a job, Zack. We're proud of you, aren't we, Jude? You can't quit med school now. You're almost there.
Tomorrow I have study group at night. If I don't go, I'll blow the final. I know it.
I'll pick her up and feed her dinner, Jude said. It was expected of her. She knew it. You study as long as you need to. Zack glanced over at her. He didn't trust her with Grace. Of course he didn't. He still remembered the early days when Jude had tried to be a grandparent and failed. Her grief had been knife-sharp then. It stabbed at the strangest times and left her for dead. Because of it, she used to oversleep and forget to pick Grace up. Once, the worst of times, Miles had come home one night to find Grace lying forgotten in Mia's bedroom in a dirty diaper, while Jude lay curled in the fetal position on their bed, sobbing, holding Mia's photo. They all knew that Jude couldn't look at Grace without feeling an overwhelming grief. Everything Grace did reminded Jude of her loss, and so she kept her distance from her granddaughter. It shamed Jude and embarrassed her, this weakness. But there was no way she could fix it. She'd tried, but in the past 2 years, she'd gotten better. She picked Grace up regularly from both kindergarten and the daycare she went to after school. It was only on the worst of days, when Jude fell into that gray world, that she crawled into bed and forgot everything she had to do and everyone around her, especially her granddaughter. I'm better now, she said to Zack. You can trust me.
Tomorrow is...
I know what tomorrow is.
Jude cut him off before he could say what they all already knew. Tomorrow would be a bad day for all of them.
But you can trust me this time.
It should have been raining. The landscape beyond her window should have been ominous and black, like ink spreading, with swollen charcoal skies and cobwebbed black leaves skidding across dirty sidewalks and crows gathered on telephone lines, a scene out of The Stand. Instead, the 6th anniversary of her daughter's death dawned bright and sunny, with the kind of cornflower blue sky that turned Seattle into the prettiest city in the world. The Sound sparkled. Mount Rainier came out to play, its vivid white peak resplendent over the city's shoulder. Still, Jude felt cold, freezing. All around her, tourists walked through the Pike Place public market, dressed in shorts and t-shirts, carrying cameras, and eating food off sticks or out of greasy white bags. Long-haired musicians staked out the primo street corner locations, hammering away at their accordions or guitars or bongo drums. One even had a piano. Jude wrapped the heavy cashmere scarf around her neck and resettled the purse on her shoulder. At the end of the market, a triangular patch of grass provided a resting spot for the homeless. A giant totem pole looked down on them. She crossed the busy street and walked up a steep hill to a swizzle stick of a building that poked high into the clear blue sky.
"Ms. Faraday?"
the doorman said, tipping his ridiculous hat at her. Unable today to smile, she nodded and walked past him. Waiting for the elevator, she tapped her foot on the tile floor and bit her lip. She took off her scarf,
and put it back on. By the time she reached Dr. Bloom's austere, glass-walled office, she was so cold she expected to see her own breath.
"You can go in, Miss Faraday," the receptionist said at her entrance.
Jude couldn't respond. She passed through the waiting area and went into Dr. Bloom's elegantly decorated office.
"Turn on the fucking heat," she said without preamble, collapsing onto the plush chair beside her.
"There's a throw beside you," her doctor said.
Jude reached down for the camel-colored mohair blanket and covered herself with it, shivering.
"What?"
she said, realizing the doctor was staring at her. Dr. Harriet Bloom took a seat opposite Jude. She was as austere as her office, steel gray hair, an angular face, and dark eyes that noticed everything. Today she was wearing a houndstooth sheath with black hose and fashionable black pumps. When Jude had first folded under Miles's relentless pressure to get help and see someone, she'd visited a string of psychiatrists and therapists and counselors. At first, her sole criterion had been their ability to disperse prescription drugs. In time, she'd weeded out the touchy-feely purveyors of hope and the idiots who told her boldly that someday she would smile again. The minute someone told her that time healed all wounds, she got up and left. By 2005, only Harriet Bloom remained. Harriet, who rarely smiled, and whose demeanor hinted at a personal understanding of tragedy. And she could prescribe drugs.
"What?" Jude said again, shivering. "It's June 9th.
Jude wanted to make a smart comeback, but she couldn't. All she could do was nod.
"Did you sleep last night?"
She shook her head. "Miles held me, but I pushed him away."
"You didn't want comfort."
"What good is it?"
"Are you going to do anything to mark the day?"
The question made Jude angry. And anger was good, better than this free-falling despair.
Like, send balloons up to her? Or sit by that granite stone in the grass where her body is? Or maybe I should invite guests over and celebrate her life, which is over.
Sometimes people find comfort in such things.
Yeah, well, I don't.
As I've said before, you don't want comfort. Harriet wrote something on her notepad.
Why do you keep coming to me? You control your feelings so tightly we can hardly make progress.
I come to you for drugs, you know that.
How are you doing? Really?
Tonight will be bad. I'll start remembering her and I won't be able to stop. I'll think that Miles was wrong, that she could have gotten better, or that if I'd kissed her, she could have woken up like a Disney princess. I'll imagine that I should have tried mouth to mouth, or pounded on her heart. Crazy things.
Jude looked up. Tears blurred Dr. Bloom's sharp face, softened it.
I'll take some sleeping pills, and then it will be tomorrow, and I'll be okay until her birthday.
Zach's birthday.
She flinched at that.
Yeah. Not that he celebrates it anymore either. When was the last time your family celebrated anything?
You know the answer to that. We're pod people, like in that Body Snatcher movie. We only pretend to be real. But why are we rehashing all of this? I just want you to tell me how to get through today.
You never ask me about tomorrow. Why is that?
What do you mean?
Most patients want to learn how to live. They want me to make a map for them that they can follow to get them to a healthy future. You simply just want to survive each day.
Hello. I'm not bipolar or schizophrenic or borderline. I'm sad. My daughter died and I'm devastated. There's no getting better.
Is that what you want to believe?
It's the way it is. Jude crossed her arms. Look, you've helped me, if that's what this is about.
maybe you think I should be doing better by now. Maybe you think 6 years is a long time. But it's not. Not when your child died. And I am doing better. I grocery shop. I cook dinner. I go out with girlfriends. I make love to my husband. I vote.
You didn't mention either your son or your granddaughter.
It wasn't meant to be an exhaustive list, Jude said.
Are you still stalking Grace?
Jude pulled her scarf off. She was hot now, sweating, in fact, and the scarf was choking her. I don't stalk her.
You stand in the trees and watch her at that after-school program, but you won't hold her or play with her. What would you call it?
Jude started to unbutton her coat. Man, it's hot.
When was the last time you held Grace? Or kissed her?
Really, it's an oven in here.
It's not hot.
Damn menopause.
Jude, Harriet said with an irritating patience, you refuse to love your granddaughter.
No, Jude said quietly, finally looking up. I can't love her. There's a difference. I've tried. Do you really think I haven't tried? But when I look at her, I feel nothing.
That's not true, Jude.
Look, Jude sighed. I get what you're doing. We've done this dance for years. I tell you I can't feel, and you toss back that I don't want to. My brain is the boss. I get it. I do. The old me would have been certain you were right.
And the new you?
The new me is living. That's enough. I don't burst into tears when I see pink anymore. I can start my car without crying. I can look at my son and not be angry at him. Sometimes I can look into his eyes without even thinking about Mia. I can pick my granddaughter up from school and give her a bath and read her a bedtime story, all without crying. You know how much progress this is. So can we just, for now, forget the next step and let me get through this day?
We could talk about Mia.
No, Jude said sharply. She'd learned a long time ago that talking about Mia only sharpened the pain.
You need to talk about her. You need to remember her and grieve.
I do nothing but grieve.
No, your grief is an artery that's been clamped off. If you don't take that clamp off and let it flow, you'll never heal.
So, I won't heal,
Jude said tiredly, leaning back into the sofa.
Big surprise. How about if we talk about Miles? We made love last week. That's a good sign, don't you think?
Harriet sighed and made a notation on her pad. Yes, Jude, that's a good sign. Every day after kindergarten was over, Grace went to the Silly Bear daycare until Daddy got home from his big boy school. On good days, like today, they all got to play outside, but Mrs. Skidder made them walk from the daycare to the beach holding a yellow, scratchy rope, like they were babies. As usual, Grace was at the very front of the line, right behind the teacher. She could hear the other kids laughing and talking and horsing around. She didn't join in. She just followed along behind, staring at the big pillows of her teacher's butt. When they reached the beach park, Mrs. Skidder gathered the 10 of them in a circle in front of her.
You know the rules. No going in the water. No fighting. Today we're going to play hopscotch in the sand. Who wants to help me make the squares?
Hands went up. Kids started yelling, me, 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 and bouncing up and down. It reminded Grace of the baby bird she'd seen at the newborns exhibit her dad had taken her to. Chirp, chirp. She walked over to her usual spot. Everyone knew she liked it here. She sat on a log in the sand, way out of the waves' reach. Sometimes, if she was lucky, she saw a crab or a sand dollar. Mostly, she just talked to her best friend. She stared down at the pink band she wore on her wrist. On its center, where there used to be a Minnie Mouse watch, her daddy had placed a small round mirror about the size of her palm. It was the best present she'd ever gotten. It had allowed her to leave her bedroom. Before the wrist mirror, she'd spent hours standing in front of her bedroom mirror, talking to her friend, Ariel, who was a princess on another planet. Grace wasn't stupid. She knew that some of the other kids made fun of her for having an invisible friend, but she didn't care. The kids in her class were stupid anyway. None of them knew how quiet this planet could be, so they hadn't learned to listen like she had. She was used to quiet. Her grandparents' house was like a library sometimes. There was something wrong with Grace. She'd known that her whole life, even if she didn't know what it was. People didn't like her, not even her grandma. Grace tried to be likable and nice and quiet, she really did. But none of it ever worked, and things just went wrong for her, no matter how hard she tried. She broke things and tripped over stuff, and couldn't seem to learn her letters.
"Hey, Grace Arena,"
Ariel said. Grace looked down at the circle of glass. She couldn't really see Ariel. It wasn't like that. She just knew her friend was there now, and she could hear the voice in her head. Grown-ups always asked Grace how she knew when Ariel was around, or what her best friend looked like. Grace told them Ariel looked exactly like Cinderella. It was sort of true. She couldn't actually see Ariel, but she knew when her best friend was in the mirror and when she was gone. And she did look like Cinderella. Grace would swear it. She still remembered the first time Ariel had shown up. Grace had been a baby, still in diapers. She'd been home with Nana, who used to babysit sometimes when Daddy was busy with school. All Grace remembered about those days was the sound of Nana crying. Everything made Nana sad. The music on the radio, the color pink, the dumb old green sweater hanging in the entry, the closed door upstairs, and Grace. Just looking at Grace made Nana cry. One day, Grace had done something wrong. She didn't know what it was. All she knew was that one minute she was standing there with a stuffed pink puppy that she'd found in her grandparents' room, and the next minute, Nana was yanking the puppy out of her hand so hard, Grace stumbled sideways and plopped onto her butt. Nana burst into tears, and so did Grace. She waited for her daddy, but no one came to get her. And finally, she just sat there, alone, sucking her thumb. Then she'd heard someone say her name.
"Gracie, come here. Follow me."
She'd wiped her slimy nose and stood up. Holding her yellow blankie, she followed the voice up the stairs to the door that was always shut. No one ever played in this room. Inside, it was like something out of a fairy tale, all pink and yellow and perfect. Over by the dresser was a big mirror that was shaped sort of like a football, with a red and gold flag stuck into the hinge. A bunch of glittery gold stuff framed the oval mirror, bracelets and metal flowers and sparkly rainbows.
"Grace Arena?"
She remembered peering into the mirror, seeing a flash of yellow and smear of pink.
"You okay?"
Grace frowned, looked harder, seeing something. A girl, maybe, a little older than her.
"Are you okay?"
the girl asked.
"I'm bad,"
Grace said, feeling tears start again.
"Grace, bad."
"You're not bad."
"Who are you?"
"I'm Ariel. I'll be your friend as long as you need me. Here, Grace Arena, lie down on the carpet. Go to sleep. I could tell you a story."
Grace had been so tired. She'd curled up on the soft carpet and pulled her blanket around her. Sucking her thumb, she'd fallen asleep to the pretty sound of her new friend's voice. Since then, Ariel had been her bestest, her only, friend.
Why don't you go play with the other kids?
Grace looked down at her wrist.
They're stupid.
She poked a stick into the sand at her feet. She traced a heart out.
Boy alert!
Grace sat up straighter and looked around. Sure enough, Austin Climes was coming this way. His face was big and fat, like someone had conked him in the head with a pan.
You want to come play hopscotch with us?
He said, breathing heavily. His cheeks were flushed, too. The teacher had made him come over here. Grace could see the other kids huddled together across the beach, watching her and giggling. They thought it was funny that no one liked her.
Ariel isn't allowed to hopscotch.
Austin frowned.
Everyone's allowed to play hopscotch.
Not a princess.
Your fake friend isn't a princess.
Shows what you know.
You're a big fat liar.
Am not.
Are too.
He crossed his big arms across his chest.
Calm down, Grace Arena. He's just a bully.
Your only friend is invisible,
Austin laughed. Grace was on her feet before she could stop herself.
You take that back, Lardo.
Who's gonna make me, you or your invisible friend?
Grace punched him right in his piggy nose. He screamed like a baby and ran for the teacher.
Oh, boy.
Grace watched the kids huddle around Austin. They turned to point at her, and then huddled again. Mrs. Skidder led Austin over to the ice chest, where she kept all her teacher stuff. In no time at all, Austin must have been fine, because he ran off to play hopscotch.
Here she comes.
Grace didn't need Ariel to tell her she was in trouble. She leaned forward and rested her arms on her thighs.
Grace?
She cocked her head up. Fine blonde hair fell across her face.
Yeah? May I sit down?
Grace shrugged.
I guess.
You know you shouldn't have punched Austin in the nose.
I know. And you're gonna have to tell his parents.
And your dad. Grace sighed.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have sent him over.
They don't want to play with me, and I don't care.
Everyone wants friends.
I have Ariel.
She's been a good friend to you.
She never makes fun of me.
Mrs. Skidder nodded. I've lived on this island a long time, Grace, and I've seen a lot of kids come and go. I used to know your daddy. Did I ever tell you that? I worked in the lunchroom when he was in high school. Anyway, the point is, everyone makes friends sooner or later. Grace shook her head.
Not me. No one likes me, and I don't care.
Things change, Gracie. You'll see. Mrs. Skidder sighed, put her hands on her thighs. Well, I was going to collect some beach stones, the pretty kind. You want to help?
I might not find any.
Or you might. Mrs. Skidder stood up, put her hand out. Grace stared at her teacher's white hand. A simple gold band on one finger meant she was married.
My daddy's not married,
she said impulsively.
I know. That's 'cause my mom is a super spy.
Mrs. Skidder frowned seriously. Really? How exciting. You must miss her.
I do, but I'm not supposed to.
For the next 2 hours, she followed Mrs. Skidder around, bent over, peering down at the rocks at her feet. One by one, the other kids went home, until finally, it was only Grace and her teacher on the beach. Mrs. Skidder kept looking at her watch and making a tisking sound. Grace knew what that meant. It was getting dark when Papa showed up.
Hey, Gracie, her grandfather said, smiling down at her.
Grandma forgot me again,
Grace said, letting the fistful of rocks tumble from her hand.
She's not feeling well, but I'm here, and I thought I'd take my best girl for ice cream. He bent down and scooped Grace into his arms. She clung to him, wrapping her legs around him like a little monkey. He carried her over to Mrs. Skidder, and they said goodbye. Then he put her into the car seat in the back of Grandma's big black car.
"You have something to tell me," he said, starting the engine.
"I do?"
She looked up, saw her grandpa looking at her in the rearview mirror.
"The fight with Austin Climes."
"Oh," Grace said, sighing. "That."
"You know you're not supposed to hit other kids, Gracie."
"He started it."
"He did? How?"
"He kicked sand in my face, and he said I was stupid."
"Really?"
"And he said a bad word."
"Still, Grace, you shouldn't be hitting kids."
"I thought you only said I couldn't hit girls."
"You don't think that."
"Okay," she said, slumping in her seat. "I won't hit Austin Climes anymore, even if he's a butt."
"You said that about Jacob Moore, too."
"But I didn't hit Jake."
She could tell that Papa was trying not to smile.
"We are not going through the kids in daycare one by one. You can't hit any of them. And before you look for a loophole, no hitting kids in kindergarten either, okay?"
"What's a loophole? Is that like a hula hoop?"
"Gracie."
"Okay. Are you gonna tell my daddy?"
"I have to."
For the first time, Grace felt truly bad about what she'd done. Now her daddy would give her that disappointed look, and she'd get scared and snuggle up to him and hope he wouldn't leave her. She didn't have a mommy. What would she do without a daddy?
Chapter 19.
"Scared? What do you mean you're scared?"
Lexi leaned against the gray wall of her cell. After 71 months in prison, she was finally getting out. She'd served her whole sentence, and then some, thanks to bad choices. So there would be no parole for her, no probation. She had a community service advocate who was prepared to help her transition. But the truth was that in a few minutes, she'd be just another citizen, free to go where she pleased. All she knew was that she was going to Florida to be with Eva. After that, her life stretched out like a desert highway, with no end or turns in sight. Strangely, now that the day was upon her, she was afraid to leave. This 10-foot square cell had become her world, and there was a safety in the familiarity of it. There were 8 steps from the bed to the toilet, 2 from the sink to the wall, 3 from the bed to the door. The walls were covered with Tamika's family photos, pictures of people that had become like family to Lexi. Her own pictures of Aunt Eva and Zach and Mia had been taken down years ago. Looking back was too painful, and a waste of time on top of it. She could never forget Mia's smile, with or without a reminder.
"Lexi?"
Tamika put down the tabloid magazine she was reading. "What do you mean you're scared?"
"I know who I am in here."
"You don't want to focus on whoever you became in here, Hermana. Especially not you. You got so much life ahead of you."
Lexi looked down at her few belongings. On the end of the bed were her prized possessions, all that she'd hoarded and collected in the past years. A shoebox full of letters, from Aunt Eva and to Grace. Mia and Zach's senior pictures, and a photograph of the three of them at a school dance, and a worn, often read paperback copy of Wuthering Heights. No more Jane Eyre for her. Why read about someone else's happy ending? A guard appeared at the door.
"Time to go, Bale."
Tamika moved slowly off the bed. In the past half-decade, as Lexi had whittled her own body down to a runner's leanness, Tamika had packed on the pounds. She claimed menopause was the culprit, but prison food didn't help. Lexi stared at the sad, dark face of the woman who had saved her in here, had been a friend when she desperately needed one. If Lexi still knew how to cry, she would have.
I'll miss you, Lexi said, wrapping her arms around Tamika's broad, rounded back.
I'll write to you, Lexi promised.
Send me a picture of you and Grace.
Tamika, I gave up that right, she said. You know that.
Tamika grabbed her by the shoulders, shook her.
You know what I would give to be walking out of here with you? Don't you dare be jello. You made a mistake and you paid for it, period.
She pulled Lexi into another hard embrace.
See your daughter, at least. Come on, Bale,
the guard said. Lexi let go of Tamika and walked over to the bed where she gathered up her few belongings. She intended just to walk out, be as cool as possible. But she couldn't. At the door, she paused and turned back. Tamika was crying.
Don't you come back, she said, or I'll whoop your white ass.
I won't, Lexi promised.
As she carried her pathetic shoebox through the prison, women catcalled and yelled to her. She remembered how they had scared her at first, these women. She was one of them now, and she knew that no matter how long she lived or how much she changed, a part of her would be here, behind bars. Maybe a part of her always had been. A girl without a mother was a prisoner of a different kind. At the desk, another uniformed guard handed her some paperwork and a bag with her own clothes in it, as well as a small manila envelope.
You can change in there, the guard said, pointing to a door down the hall.
Lexi went inside the room and shut the door. Slowly, she stripped out of her faded, worn prison khakis and secondhand underwear. Inside the bag, she found the wrinkled black pants and white blouse she'd worn to the courthouse so long ago, along with her own beige bra and black panties and a flattened patchwork denim purse. Black knee socks and cheap black flats completed the old Lexi look. Or the young Lexi. She dressed carefully, enjoying the feel of the soft cotton against her dry skin. The pants were too big for her now. They hung off her protruding hip bones. So was the bra. In her zeal to keep busy and get strong, she'd spent long hours in the gym, and her body had turned almost freakishly sinewy. Her boobs had all but checked out. She buttoned up the black pants and tucked her shirt into the baggy waistband before turning to the mirror. All these years, she'd imagined this day, pictured it. But now, when she stared at her reflection, all she saw was a tired, stringy version of who she'd been. She looked like an adult. More than that, even, she looked at least 10 years older than she was, with her pale skin, her prominent cheekbones, and colorless lips. Her black hair had been cut off a few years ago by the prison barber, who had taken all of 7 minutes to chop off 12 inches of hair. The pixie cut had grown out into soft curls that framed her angular face. She opened the yellow envelope and found an expired driver's license with a young girl's face on it, a half-empty package of gum, a cheap drugstore watch, and her promise ring from Zack. A knock on the door roused her.
Bale, you okay?
She put everything, including the ring, in her purse, threw the bag and envelope in the wastebasket, and left the room. At the prison office, she signed one document after another and took the $200 that was her exit money from the state. How a person was supposed to start a new life with 200 bucks and no valid ID was beyond her. She followed instructions and did as she was told, until she heard a door clang shut behind her, and she was standing in the open air, beneath a bright, late afternoon sky. Free air. She tilted her face to the sky, felt the day's warmth on her cheeks. She knew the van was waiting for her. It would take her to the nearest bus station. But she couldn't seem to make herself move. It felt amazingly good to just stand here, with no bars or razor wire defining her space, and no women getting in her face.
No,
Lexi?
Scott Jacobs walked up to her, smiling. He was older, his hair was short now, conservative-looking, and he wore glasses. But other than that, he looked the same. He might even be wearing the same suit.